In the preceding section, we prove that temporal death and the long direful catalogue of diseases to which human nature is incident have resulted from the first sin of Adam. It may now be asked, are these the only evils which this sin has produced? We think not. We are of the opinion that the minds and the affections of Adam's posterity have been disordered by his first sin. Upon no other principle can we account for insanity, mental and physical deformity, etc. Some men have the most retentive memory and scarcely any judgment. Others, a very sound judgment and little memory. Among men there is an infinite diversity in these respects, and we know of no cause to which to attribute these evils but the sin of Adam. Almost all physiologists and metaphysicians, we believe, admit that intellect depends upon organization. The human body is the organ upon which the human spirit performs. But if this organ has been disordered, the result of the performance will be so likewise. Hence, the human spirit which dwells in an insane person, although perhaps as perfect as that which dwelt in Sir Isaac Newton, can exhibit but very imperfect marks of intelligence. The fault is in the instrument, not in the performer. The instrument, having been shattered by some calamitous stroke, refuses to send forth those melodious notes which the same performer would cause to arise from a better instrument. If, then, intelligence depends upon organization, the only question is whether our organization has been injured by the first Adamic sin. But this point has, in effect, been already proved. It has been proved that temporal death is the effect of that sin, and if temporal death, then all diseases. And therefore, we may say, if diseases, the want of proper physical and mental organization, and consequently the want of perfect intelligence. It must be obvious to every discerning mind that a shock so powerful as to bring the whole race of man to the grave and to render us liable to every species of disease must have been sufficiently powerful to impair our physical and mental organization. But if this is the fact, it may be asked, how has it happened that all men have not been equally affected by it? We answer that as the diseases to which we are incident are controlled and directed by innumerable circumstances, so are all the influences of the Adamic sin controlled and directed by circumstances. Hence, though death temporal is the effect of the first sin, yet some persons die in infancy, while others endure the storm until old age. Some also die of one disease and some of another. The stream of evil influence springing out of the Adamic transgression in flowing its downward course through time has been divided into innumerable rills, according to the configuration of circumstances, if we may use this expression. And to this fact is to be attributed all the diversity of its effects and operations. In one case it produces a monstrous birth, in another an insane person, in another a crooked foot, in another a humpback. In one, a defective memory, in another, a defective judgment, in another, a redundancy of passion. Thus, every possible diversity of deformity, mental and physical, has been and may be produced. But had not man been cut off from the health-inspiring and life-perpetuating tree, its beautiful fruit would have been a preventive against the origin of this evil stream, so that mentally and physically the organization of the whole race would have been complete. We said that in many men there is a redundancy of passion. Perhaps it may also be said that there is a general derangement of our passions. Further than this, as it regards human passions, we cannot believe man to have been injured by the first sin of Adam. The advocates for total hereditary depravity do the human appetites and passions much injustice. We know of no natural appetite nor passion belonging to our nature which is not in itself good, and which, being directed into a proper channel, is not calculated to subserve our best interests. We could not spare one of them without injury. The mere existence of our passions is not sin. Sin originates in the running out of our passions into improper channels, in the not curbing or restraining them. Upon this principle do we account for the origin of all moral evil. Adam and Eve had their appetites and passions previously to the commission of the first sin. Had they not possessed passions, they could not have been susceptible of being tempted. Their susceptibility of temptation, however, seems to have been nearly, if not quite, as great as that of their posterity. Adam, it is presumed, loved Eve before he had sinned. It is also certain that he possessed an appetite for eating and drinking. In short, it is probable that our first parents were the subjects of all the passions, appetites, and emotions which exist in their posterity. Except only those emotions which originate in a consciousness of guilt, these they could not have experienced until after they had sinned. That the running out of our passions and appetites in improper channels, and not the mere existence of them, is sinful, ought to be to every rational mind from the following considerations obvious. The appetite for eating is not sinful until it amounts to gluttony. The appetite for drinking is not sinful until it arises to intemperance. The passion of fear is virtuous when we fear the proper object. The passion of hatred also is virtuous when properly directed. And the same may be said of all our passions and appetites. Like fire, they are good servants, but bad masters. Or like the smooth waters of some gently flowing river are productive of good until they overflow their banks, but in the time of inundation bear down and destroy everything in their progress. But in order to make, if possible, the subject more obvious, suppose a human being divested of all his present appetites, emotions, and passions. Of what good action, of what noble performance would he be capable? Just none at all. He could neither love nor hate, fear nor hope, joy nor sorrow. He could have no wish, no desire, no motive. In insensibility he would surpass all social apathy. He would no more be capable of performing any of those actions to which he is now almost irresistibly prompted and which are inseparably connected with his well-being than is inanimate matter. The inevitable conclusion, then, is that our natural appetites and passions are not in themselves sinful. They are good in themselves, and consequently productive of good in every case in which their motions are regulated by the laws of truth. We ought therefore to govern, not annihilate them. We shall have use for them every hour of our lives. Let us therefore subject them to the strict discipline of the law of the Lord. Let them be chastened, and let them be consecrated to his service, and they will not only prove highly beneficial to us, but honorable to him who made us. We have seen persons whose minds had been so perverted by the monkish doctrine of total hereditary depravity that when they beheld a child crying or fretting, they imagined that these were but the exhibitions of its depravity. Our conclusion, however, is very different. Some of the appetites and passions of children are very strong, and as their reasoning faculty has not developed itself, they are destitute of those principles which must be exerted in order to self-government. Hence, they do not possess this power. Their passions, consequently, have over them unlimited control. They are mere creatures of feeling and act their feelings, whether good or bad, upon all occasions. Hence the necessity of moral and religious education by which they shall be taught the principles of self-government. And hence, also, we may say, the necessity of all the means of salvation through the gospel, without which children could not be brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Very great care ought to be taken by parents and guardians not only to give a right direction to the principles of which the nature of children is composed, but also to prevent them from contracting bad habits. There are artificial as well as natural habits. Children ought on no occasion to be permitted to create such appetites, nor to deprave their natural ones by any kind of excessive indulgence. If these rules were observed, there would not be so many abusers of human nature, and we may add, nor spoilers of human nature. Children are, in most instances, destroyed in a moral point of view by the irrational manner in which they are raised. And then their nature is abused because it did not produce fruits the seeds of which were never sown in their minds. The reader will perceive by a candid attention to the contents of this chapter that we are of the opinion that the human race has received a very large injury from the first sin of Adam, but not enough wholly to corrupt it. We cannot, we never can admit that our fellow men are by nature as corrupt as the devil. We do know better, and we are ashamed that any of our species should ever have evinced so total an ignorance of human nature as to advocate so palpable an error. As, however, light shall increase, we may expect the declension of this monstrous doctrine.